Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I sit down with my guests to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. Chad Brown is a decorated U.S. Navy veteran who struggles to this day with PTSD. A failed suicide attempt eventually led Chad to found a nonprofit organization called Soul River, Inc. Soul River brings together at-risk youth and veterans who act as mentors. Together, they visit threatened wild spaces and embark on mission-driven experiences based around advocacy and outdoor education. In this episode of Anchored, Chad and I discuss his remarkable story, the realities of PTSD, and what it's like to be a black man in fly fishing. This episode of Anchored is brought to you by Olukai. Aloha was born in Hawaii, but the Aloha spirit holds no geographic boundaries. With Aloha as their foundation, Olukai takes a different approach to footwear. Olukai crafts only the highest quality shoes and sandals with premium materials and artistic story details with the style, durability, and versatility for today's watermen and waterwomen who lead an active ocean-bound lifestyle. Whether you're loading up the boat with supplies at the dock, fishing off the rocks, or scoping out the best place to cast from the beach, Olukai's water-ready footwear is designed to keep you sure-footed with comfortable island style through every step of your journey. Shop or find your local retailer at olukai.com/anchored. Chad Brown. Wow. You've been on my list since I started this podcast. Totally serious.
Awesome.
Yeah, you're this is long overdue. We were scheduled in May actually this year when I was supposed to be in Oregon, but then COVID hit and we decided to push it back till I was going to be back in America because I hate doing this remotely. Mm-hmm. But Chad, I'm just going to jump right into it. You are a black man and there's a lot to talk about right now, but I really, really need you to be patient with me. And I want to start with your story because when I reached out to you last year to do this podcast, we were always going to talk about diversity. I mean, that comes up often on the show, but your story for me is so unbelievably inspiring. Can we just start with you?
Yeah, sure, sure.
So let's start with where I start with everybody. Where were you born and raised?
Sure. I was born and raised in Texas, born out of Cuero, Texas, and raised up in Austin, Texas. And I was kind of back and forth. My grandma and a lot of my parents, my grandma and my grandfather lived in Cuero, Texas on a farm. And I was back and forth from the city. And then the summers I'll spend time with my grandparents out in the country. Yeah. So, but yeah, you know, it's I was talking to someone earlier today about my background, and I'm a little bit blessed. I was born, you know, with the outdoors, not the fishing part, but on my father's side, I come from a really long line of farmers and hunters and black cowboys. And so I grew up with the background of going to black rodeos and on Sundays in the afternoon and summer around the big tree and the family tree, our entertainment was me seeing my father and his brothers and his father going out into the pasture and wrestling bulls. you know. And so so it's a very interesting background of my, you know, brought up, and I was, you know, bows and arrows and all that kind of stuff, you know, but not fishing. It was just, and then the farming, and my mother gave me the balance of art and music and theater. And so that was also her background as well, what she did as professionals wrote theater, basically for churches and stuff.
So how did you get into fishing then?
Fishing came way later in my life after a lot of trials and a lot of things that I'd done, you know, golly, I guess you could say where I started later in my life after the military and getting my education. I got into a profession as a photographer, designer, and got offered a job to Portland, Oregon, and got hired into an agency as a senior art director. And that was when things started to go south with me and started to lose a lot of weird things started happening with me. I started to lose direction, losing track of my thoughts, getting angry. You know, and I didn't know what was going on, but those were the pre-stages that I was facing and dealing with, which was a form of PTSD. You know, and sooner or later, I got to a point where I lost everything. You know, I couldn't function even getting a job anymore. I couldn't hold down a job, and it got really bad in my life where I became homeless, and I lived on the streets in Portland for 12 months. And the only way I was able to support myself, which I didn't really support myself, but I would, you know, it's really weird because I came from all these challenges in my life, military, school and everything, profession. And here I am standing in a blood mine, giving $20 for a pint of blood to put gas in my tank and put food in my stomach, you know, and that's kind of like what I was doing for a couple of years. And got to a point where I was doped up on heavy medication from the VA. And, you know, one day I went out to the river and drew my weapon and attempted to commit suicide. And I was so strung up and on dope, you know, not street dope, but the medication I was getting from the VA, that I blacked out. Cops found me, that I was a vet, took me up to the VA, and found out I was a vet. And so I was up in the VA in the psych ward for 7 days to prove to the doctor I was going to hurt myself, you know. And right at that point, there was a lady friend of mine that took me to the river and said, this is where I used to come to when I was dealing with my divorce problems and stuff, you know. And so that was when fishing came into my life, and she showed me, and just so happened there was a fishing store right behind us, and we walked over there, got me a fly rod, and didn't really know anything about fly fishing. I just picked one up and got some gear and put something, whatever, I didn't know what I was doing, put something together. And went back to that river where she was at, and I cast out, hooked into a jack salmon, and I was hooting and hollering all over the place. You know, I was strung out on heavy medication, but I was hooting and hollering so much that, you know, it was kind of like it was kind of like I've been a walking zombie for a very, very long time, to where I couldn't smile. I lost feelings. It was just this. I was just existing. And then when I hooked in on that jack salmon, I felt this urge of happiness and excitement. And at the same time, I became really sensitive to the air. And I remember just the wind, you know, in nature, and the wind just brushing across my cheek. I felt that, you know, and it made me feel alive. And, you know, and then I was feeling that my excitement was kind of like pushing a lot of this medication in my body out of my pores. My excitement was pushing this medicine out of me. And so I started putting one and one together and two, and I was just like, you know, this is something that makes me happy, and this is something that what I want to do. Went back to the VA, talked to my docs. My docs literally wrote me a prescription of fish more. If you continue to fish more and do group therapy, then we'll slowly wean you off your medications. And, you know, I guess the story is written. I fish more. That was my commitment to the VA hospital, you know, and so I continue to fish more and fish more. And of course, growing a new community, learning a new way of looking at our environment, our nature. And it was not something of knowledge that I even had when I was in New York and school and military, this was a whole new thing. And so I became a pupil to the river, a pupil to a new community of anglers and hunters and conservation folks. I was a pupil from all over. I was even kind of like a, I would call like a roadie, you know, like a roadie that's picking up the bags for a rock group. I became kind of like a roadie for guides, you know, and I didn't guide, but I was just out there just to soak in, you know, as much as I could, you know, from every guide that I was able to connect with. And my exchange of getting on the boat and going on the guided trip is that I would handle all the bags, you know, I was humble, you know, just handle all the bags and bring them in and be an assistant to wherever I could be an assistant to help the guide out. And it was just a time for, I probably did it probably a good 4 or 5 years of just living like that. You know, a lot of times I lived out on my rig and it was just, yeah, it was just a really weird place, you know, and chasing my demons. And so that's really what has helped me was fishing. Yeah.
That's a lot for me. I don't know if it's a lot for everybody, but it's a lot for me to digest. And I hope that you don't mind if I go back and pick my way through it a bit.
Yeah, I don't mind. No.
Okay. So you, I'm assuming you just had a regular childhood where you have, you just were a regular kid, but you didn't fish in high school, obviously.
No.
And then you
let's stop right there. I mean, I don't know what you mean by a regular childhood, but my childhood was what I just shared with you, but also, you know, my family was separated, my father and my mother. And so I came from a broken home, but my mom and my dad happened, they were just good friends. And the rest was, I was also, which a lot of people don't know, or some people know, but, I was also in the gangs. And so I was, heavily in the gangs and growing up through high school, fighting a lot and, got stabbed a couple times in my legs. And, my mom was my saving grace. And so there was another part of my life growing up where she connected me to the Big Brother, Big Sister program. It just so happened I remember his name's Captain Maxwell, the head police department in Austin, Texas. And he would, mentor me, you know? And so, so there's a couple pieces happened. So I don't know if it's average, but
I would say not. How on earth do you get into gangs? Like, how does that happen? I know it's different for everybody, but how did that happen for you?
You know, that's a good question. I don't really know how it happened other than, I think, you know, it's interesting to say I wasn't looking for it. It was just something. I was young. I was really young, you know, and my mom was working two jobs and putting herself through college. And my dad was, you know, living like 150 miles away and he was doing his thing. So my mom wasn't home as much, but she did the best that she can do to support me and my brother. And so she would, you know, cook a big old pot of beans and we'll make those beans last the whole entire day. But that would be me and my brother's food and while she's out. That's literally what she'll do. She'll get up really, really early in the morning. She'll make this huge big pot of beans, you know, and it's right there on the stove and everything, you know. And so that way she knows that we always have food, can always take, you know, our little bowl and put it in there and everything like that. And that's kind of like the routine and everything. So we had food right there. Me and Brian, we always get our beans and put it in there, get creative. And because we get tired of eating beans, you know, but that was it, you know, and she would leave. And so she would come back until, late. I don't know, 8, 9 o'clock late in the afternoon and at night, basically. And so me and my brother, we were, you know, left to, you could say really fend for ourselves for that time frame while my mom was gone and working one job and out of another job and going to school. And also we would go to, you know, me and my brother, we would walk to school, get dressed and everything. And that was like the routine. And so I think by my mom being absent, where it's understood why she was absent, but there was a lot of time lag, you know, maybe at home. And that time lag, it opened itself up to many other possibilities. You know, it's like if you got too much time, you can easily find trouble. And so I think there's a lot much more opportunity of influences that come into that time lag between, you know, 5 a.m. and she's not coming back until 9 at night, you know. And so me and my brother were there, we're going to school, you know, get something to eat. And so you know, there was a lot of that. And my father, you know, my father, he would pop in randomly to pick us up, take us out, but he wasn't there consistent. So when my father wasn't there, you know, I was drawn more into a lot of the kids, you know, from high school and stuff, and make friends. And some of those friends were probably, well, they were bad friends too, and tied into community gangs. And that's what led me, I guess, led me into that. It filled an emptiness of family, you could say, you know, and that time, and like brothers. And so I would say that's probably how I got into it. It was just, you know, seeking that family, you know, and they became my family at that time.
That makes sense. I can understand that. And then what about getting into the service? Because that just seems like such a stark contrast. It is and it isn't when you think about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Standing, teaming up together, I guess technically with like-minded people to stand for something you believe in.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to say brotherhood in a lot of ways, even though that's not politically correct. But
yeah.
How did you make that transition from that past life or, you know, the I'm just going to call it for what it is, but like the gang sort of affiliation to serving your country?
Yeah. So, you know, as I was moving forward with the gangs and stuff, I wasn't that great in school, but I did get accepted to a junior college in Dallas. It was the Art Institute of Dallas. And so I've always been creative and been artistic. And that became kind of like a driving part in my life to want to go to school. At the same time, I did have one foot in and out of the gangs. I was constantly fighting that. You know, once we get involved in that kind of stuff, it's very, very hard to get out of. And so as I'm fighting that and also going to school at the same time, it got to a financial point where I basically didn't have enough money to finish school. And so my only way or my only option that was in front of me was to join the Navy. And, you know, I was always kind of against the military. I wasn't really down with it. My father served, my uncle served, you know, that's another, on some of my dad's side of the family, it's all military. So I really wasn't down to doing it, but I really did it because the fact that I needed money for school. I wanted to finish school. I liked what I was doing, what I was studying. And so that was my exit out. And so I joined, you know, and didn't realize that what I was getting into, but yeah, crazy, crazy ride.
What were you trying to, or what were you taking in school? What did you want to do?
I was going into the school to take up commercial art is what they call it at that time before it turned into communication design, you know? So I was going to school to take on commercial art, study commercial art, be a graphic designer.
Okay. That makes sense. Okay. So then you go over, I'm super ignorant to service and that part of America, even though I've got no excuse for, like, obviously Canada's got military, but so what happens? You get deployed, you go overseas. Where did you go?
You know, when I joined, I kind of really joined at the wrong time. I thought I was going to the Cold War, but at that time it was turning from the cold, to basically, you know, a hot war, basically some people call it. So when I went in, it was right when Desert Storm was popping off. And so after boot camp, you know, I went up and done my schooling when I was in Orlando, Florida. Then I got my assignment up to Williamsburg, Virginia. And when I got there, it was the beginning of my roller coaster ride of being in the military. I was deployed all over. The longest I stayed in the United States was 3 months in my Navy stint, and I was in the 14 different countries back to back, third world countries. I was in the Desert Storm, Desert Shield War, and also Somalia, Operation Restore Hope. Then I was sent down to Cuba. My last deployment was actually down in Antarctica in the bottom of the world for 4 months on the ice. And then I got my papers to, you know, for getting out of the military. So I spent a lot of my time in a lot of third world countries, behind enemy lines, 14 different countries, and in two wars, basically.
When you say you got your papers, I'm assuming
my discharge papers.
Was that because of an injury or a mental issue, or were you?
No, I was done. It was my contract was up, you know, of my enlistment. You know, you get your your walking papers, you know, to go home. You know, you've done your time and time to go home, basically.
Talk to me about PTSD, because I think I always associate it with somebody who's had a really traumatic, singular event rather than it being an entire period of their life. What is PTSD for you? What has it been for you?
PTSD is exactly what you said. You know, every veteran, every soldier has experienced that. You know, it's really when you have experienced a traumatic event. It could be a one-off event, or it can be a long-term, ongoing type of events, a series of events that has happened. You know, and so it's a place where your body and your mind is not made to cope in an extreme type of situation, a trauma, and whether it could be a physical trauma or a mental trauma, it's just that we're not made up for that, you know, and that's just not how we made, you know. So it cripples you. It, you know, as a veteran, it affects people in many different ways. It kind of depends on the makeup of your, I don't know the scientific, but makeup of your body and the makeup of your mind, you know, it really affects everybody in different ways, you know, but there's a similarities that one veteran will have to a certain degree, which it could be like depression, anxiety. When you start getting to the sensitivities of smells and colors, et cetera. Those are case by case, you know, or sounds, you know, loud sounds. That's also case by case. It just depends on what you have been exposed to and what you went through, you know, and how you make that association to how that association is made to the triggers. And those triggers are the sounds, the colors, the lights, the noise, et cetera, you know. So it really depends on that individual and that individual's trauma, what they've been exposed to, you know. But it's a crippling mental disease. It's also something that you never really find a healing for it. It's an ongoing type of work in progress that the individual has to do to continue to develop a better skill set to help fight that type of mental disease. And it's a hard fight. It's a very, very dark fight. And in a lot of family and wives, husbands, et cetera, it's that disease has been known to tear up relationships. And just for the mere fact that the people that are trying to support that individual, there's this place where they just don't know how to support that individual to a point where it becomes very disruptive and it just, you know, it just explodes. And to the person that's trying to support it, the reality, it wears that person out. And I think that's where the relationships tends to fall off or whatever relationship that you have, because it's hard. It's really hard, you know, especially when you haven't seek the help and or got the right kind of medications to be able to level you out. And also why you're doing that, the person or the group or whoever's just trying to support you, you know, they also have to go through a process of counseling and learning how to support what you've been through and how to cope with your PTSD and your triggers. It's a heavy overhaul change, not just for the person fighting that mental disease, but it's also, it puts the family through some serious loops and changes within their own environment where they have to work around supporting that person at the same time supporting themselves to keep a healthy space moving forward. It's a very delicate walk. It's hard. It really is hard. You know, it's extremely hard, and it's a long fight. You know, it really is a long fight. I believe that's why you have so much of a high rate of veterans that are killing themselves a month. I think it's like 22 a month, some 22 or more a month, actually, you know, of veterans, because it gets to that place where they, you know, it's a hard fight. Dealing with demons, and to people who are non-veterans, you know, who get the, you know, PTSD, like women, you know, women may go through a serious trauma of rape as a rape victim, you know, and even though she may get the help, but she's stuck with this heavy, heavy weight, this heavy trauma, you know, so the touch of her husband, just a, you know, his hand can come on her shoulder. She's jerking. She's pulling away, you know, and so these are triggers. And so the husband, you know, says, you know, the tables are turned. The husband actually has to learn how to work and support his wife now, because what she's went through is so traumatizing that it is adding a leverage and a heavy weight on their relationship. And the question is, can that husband be able to sustain a healthy relationship supporting his wife? You know, and so that's a heavy, heavy, hard thing to deal with. And the only reason why I brought that, because I wanted to kind of make that transition where normal people, regular people can be able to understand that other than just a veteran, you know, because there is that levels of triggers from, you know, regular civilian versus veteran. And when you are traumatized, you're traumatized on the third degree. And these are the ramifications that that happens when it comes to family members trying to support somebody with a mental trauma disease, you know, but yeah. It's tough.
Yeah. I mean, survivors of car accidents, plane crashes, they have PTSD, right?
Yeah. You know, so yeah, whatever your body go through, that shock, that absorbent of a bang, you know, or a blow to the head, that's all trauma. That turns into a form of PTSD where you got to seek and get the right kind of help.
Maybe I shouldn't be asking this, but I'm probably going to ask you a lot of things I, you know, shouldn't be asking. What was your bang? What was the bang for you?
What do you mean the bang?
The PTSD bang.
Yeah, I'll only go into a little bit. I don't really want to go on. It was war. I lost brothers. I was in some really bad situations and some pretty sticky situations that I had. It took me a long time and still to this day hard to try to find closure with and deal with. And so there was just some, you know, I'll just say this, you know, war is ugly. There's a lot of bad things that happens behind enemy lines. Man becomes something that you, the things that man can do, in war, it's worse than watching a movie. And there's no rule book when things starts going off and you do what you need to do to survive. You do what you need to do to get home without trying to get into a body bag, and you go after and you support your brothers and you're there and that's your family. And so there's a lot of things. It's very, very chaotic. It's a lot of chaos. It's just, yeah.
Yep. Here's my broader question. Is it even possible to go to war and come back without PTSD?
I don't know. I've never met anybody that, I don't know. That's a good question. You know, it's possible to go into the military and come back with no PTSD if you didn't go to war. But I've also come across men and women that just went, that served right here in the United States on base. And they had their own version of experience that has led them to PTSD as well, you know? And so I think it really just depends on, it really comes down to your walk. Everybody's walk is different. You can have an experienced trauma serving on base in the United States without having to go to war. You could, you know, easily be in a car accident or something, you know, I don't know. PTSD is a tough deal.
Okay. So you get put on medication, which is pretty standard. I think that there's a lot of that, right?
There's a lot of it.
Being prescribed medicine. Yeah. You go to the river, you're in this horrible situation where you're planning on hurting yourself, which is unfortunately a very common situation that has probably, I don't think it's not new, right? What does it show? Like, is it going up or has it always been this common, but it just hasn't been as in our faces with media?
Yeah. You know, that's a good question. I can't really speak to like the Vietnam era, you know, of veterans that came back. You know, it's really interesting because, you know, not just to change the conversation, but when you got veterans from the Vietnam era, veteran from the Desert Storm era and from the Afghan era, you're talking about literally three different type of veterans. You really are, you know, it's three, you know, even though we all serve and we have a lot in common to a certain degree, you know, that veteran that's from the Vietnam era is a different animal compared to the veterans who are coming from the Desert Storm era and from the Afghan era. You know, it's three totally different type of animals, but we all wear the same uniform and we had to do what we need to do, you know. And so I don't know the suicide rate from the Vietnam era. I would know that. I know they had a really bad time. That's a historical thing that everybody know. When those veterans came back from Vietnam era, they had a really bad time. And I don't think that, you know, PTSD was not probably the acronym that they were used. I think it was shell shock. And the medicine was different, you know, how they treated their vets and their soldiers. It's a whole, complete different type of era, you know. So maybe the suicidal rate was much higher, I guess. I don't know. I do know from what I've heard from other vets is there is this mentality of fighting in silence. A lot of Vietnam vets and meaning basically not seeking the help, you tough it out, and you know, and so you find a lot of vets, and then you got a lot of Desert Storm vets, which I was part of, and I think that was probably the beginning of a high suicide rate because it's like I said, it's a different era, different period, and so there's guys like myself that went out, and when we came back, that was probably I believe that was the beginning of calling it PTSD. Other than shit, you know, and that was probably the peak when things started to turn around. You start seeing, you know, suicides. And then from the Afghan war, the recent war, Afghanistan war, then you got more vets coming back with different diagnoses and different forms of PTSD as well. And so that really spiked up the suicidal rate. But I think what you find in a lot of the vets, some of the vets from the Desert Storm era and then the Afghanistan era, a combination was those veterans are much more vocal in their advocacy for themselves and for other things that they need versus a veteran from the Vietnam era. But yeah, so I hope I'm not sure if I answered your question though.
No, you have, because you put it into perspective of how every era is different. And the other thing to consider as well is, you know, we say suicide, but And like, I don't want to get into definitions of words, but a lot of these men in my eyes did kind of commit suicide in that they dove into a bottle. A lot of them just dove into alcoholism and that in turn ended their life in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was a lot of that. There was a lot of that, you know, and I think, and that's, you know, when looking at the VA system here in the United States, it's always been kind of like behind the eight ball of not being able to catch up to support a lot of our vets. And so there was a lack of attendance, being able to seek, you know, doctors to get the help when you go into the VA. You know, I mean, this is crazy. The stuff that I went through, and I can put this in real perspective for you versus a Vietnam veteran and any other veteran. But, you know, the stuff I went through in my peak was probably, say, 12, 13 years ago. I was really, really in a dark place. And when I went to the VA to check in, I had to wait almost, I'm going to say, a max of 2 hours just to see a doctor, which that's a translation into civilian world. That can be, you know, kind of average. Some people experience that. But what you want to experience is that when I go through and come back and get my medication, I'll get a number. And here it is, 10 o'clock in the morning. And I'm still sitting there by 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm still waiting to get my meds, you know. And so that system is so archaic, it's unbelievable. And the paperwork is so slow, you know, for your benefits and everything. So it's really sad, you know. I had friends of mine and my ex-girlfriend would come, you know, and she didn't believe it, you know. So she would make a trip with me to the VA and she was like, oh, my God. It's like, you know, I said, wow, yeah. It's like you walking through a wounded war zone. You're seeing even Korean vets, Vietnam veterans, Desert Storm veterans, Afghanistan veterans, all the way from 1921 all the way up to 80 years old. Some of them doesn't have limbs. Some of them has limbs. Some of them has mental issues. Some of them don't have mental issues. And they're all sitting there with the white, a little white piece of paper in their hand with the number waiting to get their call. And so every veteran knows this. If you go to the VA, you get that call and you get a brown bag. They give you the brown bag of medicine. and they put that medicine in that brown bag, and that's your bag of your meds that you take off and you use to take and help you cope through, you know, not having nightmares, to not having anxiety attacks, not being able to have visions, to all kinds of stuff, you know. And so it's a dark place, you know. I think the VA is getting better, I guess, from, you know, but when I was there, that was like 12, 13 years ago. And that's kind of like how the process was. When I was able to get my benefits, when I finally got my benefits in the VA, they finally had to go through a lot of series of evaluations and medical examinations and stuff. And then finally got it. They, you know, stamped me down, you know, Mr. Brown, you're 50% mentally disabled, a United States veteran, blah, 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 blah. And so that opened up for my benefits. And then I had to fight for my benefits. I had to wait almost 2.5 years to get my benefits, you know, and it was really, really hard. I walk in one day to check up because it was crazy. It was a life. I was living in my rig. I didn't have enough money to get down to the VA because I really wanted, I was living and hoping that my benefits was going to arrive. So I would either beg for money or I would like walk almost 10 miles to the VA to check in on my benefits, on my benefits. And so when I did get to the VA to check on my benefits, I remember when they walked in and I have someone there to represent me, you know, like a champion, I forgot what we call it, but they were like a representation of me to help me through my paperwork. They come back to me and says, Mr. Brown, are you sure you served for your country? You know, and I just literally lost it. I lost it. I actually got kicked out of the building. I lost my mind. I said, are you serious? You know, and then it got to a point where they needed proof. And luckily, all the proof my mom had, and I had to give my mom a phone call. And so she had to go to Kinko's and fax all my military records over to the VA because they failed. They said, we can't find your records. We can't find your DD-214. We can't find, and my mom, so she faxed everything over, and then it said, and then of course I found out that they apologized, you know, and it was crazy. So that's how archaic the VA is, you know, it was crazy. It was crazy. And so if you can imagine, you're trying to navigate all of this on your own and you're mentally challenged right now, you know what I'm saying? You're getting triggered left and right. You can't, if you can't hold a job down to operate, you can imagine what kind of headspace that you're in trying to navigate paperwork, you know, government paperwork and everything like that, you know. So it's tough, you know, and that's the kind of mess and kind of stuff that does sends a lot of veterans over the top too, you know, suicide, you know. It's a stressful situation. And a lot of vets are not in that headspace to really operate and function like that.
Yeah, it sounds exhausting. Okay, so you go to the river to hurt yourself in the most extreme way, and this miracle hits you, fly fishing.
Yeah.
Could it have been any form of fishing, or was it fly fishing specifically?
You know, I think, no, at that time, it was fly fishing. I didn't know what fly fishing was. I just got something and got gear. That's all I did. And you hear me, and I still call it gear, even though it's flies, you know. But, yeah, it was gear to me. Oh, cool, pretty cool. You know, what? I don't know, you know. So I just tied it. I didn't know anything knots. I tied a regular, I don't know, a hand-over-hand square knot. I don't know. It was just, yeah, I didn't know what I was doing, you know. And I just kind of cast out. It was all luck, but that luck is what made me feel whole, though. It turned into a jack salmon, you know. I was like, hey, you know, it was just jumping all over the place.
So in your case, it was the fish that really set it off for you. Did it end up, like, were you able to really recognize any of the other attributes that were really helping bring you into a healthy headspace? Was it the flow of the water?
No.
You'd mentioned the wind on your face. Was it any of that, or was it the fish?
It was just hooking into a fish. That's all it was for me at that time. It was just hooking into a fish because I was clueless about the river, you know, flowing and the wind and everything. Cause I was so drugged. I was drugged up on meds, you know? And so when I hooked in on that fish, that's what brought me to this new life of like, hello, you know, I'm a new kid on the block, you know, and I was hooting and hollering all over the place. And I mean, I was screaming. I think I people was all next to me. They was like, why is he so acting so loud? You know, but yeah, I let my colors show that day. I will never forget. It was a really, it was an awesome, special day for me. You know, I'll never forget that day and that joy that I had and how hooking on that one fish, it just made me feel alive. I felt myself in the present. It was like I woke up my soul all this time. It was like, wow, I've been sleeping all this time and I just woke up, you know?
Yeah,
it was awesome. Yeah.
Okay, so what happened next then? Obviously, you got the fishing bug, which most of us are super familiar with. So yeah. What was the next step for you? Did you just dive all in?
I dive all in. I was all in. You couldn't, you know, it didn't matter where I laid my head because I was still in and out homeless and everything like that. I did not care. I had a fly vise I would tie right there in my front seat of my car, and I would tie flies, and I have all these books. Any money that I would get when I was, you know, getting money from the bloodlines and everything, and I'll go and buy me some like fly tying books, and I would look at them, and then I'll spend time over the fly shops became my haven when they were opened up, especially on weekends. I would go to the fly shop and I would sit down with old heads, the old white anglers, and you'll know it's really cool. You walk in and you see a big old Folgers cup over there, you know, Folgers coffee, you know, and I'll sit down, I'll pour me some coffee, and I'll sit down there all day. And, you know, we have nothing in common except fishing, you know, and so, and I'll sit there and I'll just soak in all the lies that the fishermen would say, you know, and I would look at their flies and all kinds of stuff. And yeah, I was just like all in, you know, and that's where I picked up a lot of my friends, on the river, you know, and learned how to tie flies. I learned how to build rods, and I would just spend time at the fly shops talking to all the guides and asking them questions. And yeah, that was my life. I just like, yeah, I literally dove into the sport. I literally dove into it. Yeah.
I met you at the fly shop.
You did? I don't remember.
Yeah, it would have been like, I'd have to get my timeline right. I met you in Welch's at Mark's shop.
That was a Christmas, right? Like, I think it was a Christmas.
Yeah.
Christmas.
Yeah, and it would have been close to 10 years ago.
Wow, that's a long time.
And you stuck out like a sore thumb, not obviously because you're a black man. I mean, let's just keep it real, right? Yeah. But and you're an attractive black man. You caught my eye and you came in super, you were super sharp looking, like you were so well-dressed. But you came in, you had this like tight shirt on. I try to remember, I think you have, do you have tattoos?
I do have tattoos. Yeah.
And I just remember thinking to myself, who is that?
Oh my goodness. Well,
but you were very comfortable in the shop. Like you obviously had spent a lot of time there, but yeah, that's where I met you all that time ago. So Talk to me then about the next step in your fishing career. Cause I remember when you started Soul River. Tell us about what Soul River started as.
Soul River started, once when I was coming out of a lot of my learning and getting good at what I was doing and growing a stronger community, I got a little bit stronger to points for myself where I felt comfortable that it was like ready in time for me to get back into society. And I said to myself, and I was actually on the Clackamas River wading the water, and I was like, I'm ready to kick some butt to get back, but for me to get back, I want to do something of like starting my own thing or whatever, but I want to do something in the realm of using my passion of what I found, which was fly fishing, and using it as a way to bring people together, you know, working with kids and working with veterans and bringing this, I was kind of like juggling, and I kind of was sharing the idea with a couple of people, and it did go into kind of like a little small product type of thing of me putting hats together and all this kind of stuff and everything like that to sell to make extra money and everything like that. And I kind of really didn't know where it was going to grow. I was really doing something and feeling my way through to see what works and what doesn't work and how it's going to land, you know, and so I didn't go to school to create a nonprofit. That was not my thing or what I wanted to do, you know, and it was only circumstance that forced me into a place and led me into growing and doing a nonprofit, which became Soul River. And Soul River evolved. It evolved in many different places, in many different levels. And I started out, you know, with the local anglers or friends of mine, and they helped me. You know, I remember I came out with Soul River hats, and a lot of people was wearing the Soul River hats and buying the Soul River hats and stuff. You know, and that was all I had, you know. And I said, yeah, man, here, you know, we, you know, promote the brand. And, you know, it was awesome. People was like, buddy, it was awesome. It was great. You know, it was like a little small little movement happening, you know. And I was still, again, I was still trying to figure out, put my finger on, like, what's the next steps.
Chad, I'm going to interrupt you because I got to tell you something. You were doing all of that when it was still, when the fly fishing industry was still making this transition from kind of the old crusty sport into this cool new age vibe, right? The trope bump era, the new videos.
Yeah.
Like I remember that.
I forgot about that. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Golly, that was gutsy. People thought I was nuts and crazy, you know, but yeah, it was a fun ride. It was fun, you know, it was really fun. But no, you're absolutely right. You know, and speaking of that cool, funky, I remember when I first did my trade show, you know, and I had, you know, a couple of anglers with me and everything, and they would follow me and say, yeah, we want to help you out. I said, okay. You know, so I had my banner, Soul River banner, and some swag and all this kind of stuff. And then I brought in these speakers, and I put each speaker on the side, and I just started rolling with Barb Marley up in there, you know. You know, and people and everybody is like looking at me like, what is that? What's going on and everything? You know, and so, yeah, I said, this one, feel the vibe, you know, bring it in and have some flavors, some, you know, and everything like this. Yeah, but it was good. It was good. It was a really good, interesting, fun time. The industry, if they didn't accept me, they forcefully accepted me, you know, and it was good. It was good, you know. And so, but sooner or later, it started to evolve. And my next step, what I started to realize was I have a really big passion of, you know, education, teaching, connecting with our youth and also our veterans, you know, and that started to become the early stages of forming my nonprofit. And when I started doing that, that's when I started seeing a vision of what I wanted to do, really what I wanted to do. It goes back to that day when I first experienced that Jack Salmon, and what it did to me is something that I embraced so much that I wanted every youth and veteran to be able to feel that same experience going out and catching their first fish. And that became my walk, you know, for the organization, the mission, the Soul River. And then, of course, later down the road, you know, my voice started to change with that, because I was like saying, you know, it's Soul River, you know, it's founded in fly fishing, and what we do is we break down the barriers. We go into wild spaces that are at threat, and that's what mobilizes into what we call them deployments. And we find places that are having issues on land, public land, fresh water, fisheries, wildlife, and whatever those issues are, we would, you know, connect with the conservation group that's doing the good work to help protect, advocate, or save whatever's happening there. And we use them as a way of, by them being the professionals, the experts in that field, we use them to help us build out a curriculum onto this deployment. And the veteran steps up, they take that curriculum, they teach into these wild spaces that are at threat. And this curriculum is basically engaging the youth and bringing their awareness up to all the issues that are happening. The youth are tasked with research and assignments that they have to do. And they basically, the ultimate goal of veterans is to raise them into outdoor leaders for tomorrow, you know? And so that's kind of like where the maturity of the organization started to mature. And, you know, and then it moves into like injustice, of the environment, environmental justice, and dealing with injustice issues, because I work with a lot of youth of color, including veterans, also disability, and also LGBTQ community. And so all the issues that they face, they bring that into the outdoor environment. You know, it doesn't separate. And so they bring that into it. So real issues tags along with the bodies that goes into the deployment. And so we're having to deal with real issues and at the same time deal with environmental issues. And so it's a lot of work, but it's fun.
Coming up, Chad and I continue our conversation. Again, thank you to Olokai for making this episode possible. Fishing is at the heart of Hawaiian culture today, just as it has been for centuries. Generations of fishermen and women expertly cast from rocky shorelines and sandy beaches. They spearfish, throw nets, fly fish, and navigate their boats beyond the reef and into the deep blue in search of their next big catch. No matter how they do it, there's an attention to detail and respect for the ocean that guides their passion. At Olokai, they believe in the same attention to detail when crafting the highest quality shoes and sandals built for every type of marine environment. Olokai's water-friendly Nohia Moku slip-on shoe features razor siping with non-marking rubber for extra grip on the deck, the dock, or the rocks, and it's designed for easy on-off barefoot wear. Whether you're loading up the boat, shoreline fishing from the rocks, or scoping out the best place to set up on the beach, Olokai takes you one step further. Shop or find your local retailer at olokai.com/anchored.
I mean, obviously, in seeing what's going on in the world right now, I think a lot of us can see how it's a lot of work. And before we talk about that, which I don't even know how we're going to broach, well, we're just going to dive right in. But what are the logistics of your program? Because it's really inspiring. So if I was a young, troubled 17-year-old who was in a similar situation to you on the river and lost, or in on my couch and lost, how does it work? Do they just reach out to you? Do they visit the website?
Yeah, they just basically go online, and we have three portals, portals of applications. We have one for veterans, one for youth, and one for volunteers. And the youth will just go to that one that's for youth, and they'll pull that application down, fill it out, and submit it. You know, and when they submit, we're not looking to turn a youth away of qualifications, et cetera. What we're trying to do is extract as much information that we can about the youth where we can learn and understand how to place them in Soul River on a deployment. The more information we know about the youth, the better off we are, because when on our deployments, we travel in small groups and tight quarters. And so the more information we know, it helps us be able to make sure that youth has a successful experience when they go on deployment and when they come back from deployment, you know. And so, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just wondering how it works. Because remember you said deployment to me when we were arranging this podcast last year. And I was like, oh, I thought you were done going, overseas. And you said, no, different deployment. So right. How many people, how many participants versus how many applicants?
Yeah. So we would average, I would say anywhere between 40 to 50 or close to 60 applicants per a deployment season. Our season is from late May and it goes to September. And we would average around, I'm going to say anywhere between 4 to 7 deployments per season. It kind of depends on what's going on. All of the applicants are 100% on deployments. We don't turn them back. You know, they just apply, you know, so all applicants, every youth that comes in, if you apply, you're on a deployment, you know, and like that, you know, so all the youth come through. Absolutely. Once when the applications are submitted, I have an application committee that's made up with me, one of my staff members, and a board member, and we will sit down one-on-one with every youth and every veteran and every volunteer. It has to be in person, not by phone. With the youth, it has to be in person with their parents or with their guardian. And we get to know the parent as well, because the parent is taken along through the process, because we have to earn that trust with that parent from then to let us take their youth 3,000 or 4,000 miles away, you know. And so we started at an early stage by bringing in that parent and that youth. And then every time we have a clinic to engage with that youth, we actually invite the parent along with them through that whole process, you know. So they're going through the process. There's clinics that's established. for each deployment. And that clinic covers everything from gear prep, preparation to, you know, the psychological part of how to control, you know, emotions and et cetera, being in the outdoors under stressful situations, et cetera, how to cope. A lot of veterans would go through this, you know, especially veterans who's not used to working with kids. So we would have clinics for veterans to learn how to talk to kids. If there's happened to be like high winds coming in really hard and you, instead of yelling it, et cetera, this is how you would talk to a kid in a stressful situation. Cause we never know, some kids may have their own triggers as well. And so what I'm speaking to is clinics, but what we also have is like a big orientation day. That orientation day, it used to be one day, but now it's 2 days. And it's two long full days of nothing but back-to-back clinics. It brings all the youth, all the veterans, including parents, under one roof. And we're in these series of clinics are clinics from a psychological place, from the medical. It's fun, you know, breakdown, get to know you type of clinics. A good example is like an icebreaker, where it's one of my favorite ones. I created this one myself is, we would put all the vets, we'll put like a 3-to-1 or 2-to-1, put all the vets in teams, and each vet will have their youth. And we'll be in a huge, big room. And so what happens is that the veteran would get blindfolded, and each veteran's blindfolded. And so we would bring a bag and drop a bag with each group, and we'll turn that bag over and drop. And when we open that bag and drop, it's a tent with all the little pieces all over the place. And now the youth have to navigate the veteran to put together the tent while the veteran is blindfolded. It's hilarious. It's hilarious. It's completely hilarious. I mean, it's fun. And it's so much of an icebreaker because you're seeing you jumping over the veteran and the youth trying to talk to them, trying to communicate. Because, we, you know, now we're challenged because we have to build communication skills. You know, the veteran can't see. So the veteran's doing all this and everything. And you got the youth saying, no, you left. No, oh, I'm sorry. You're right. You know, all that kind of stuff and picking up. And so it takes a good while, but it is hilarious. But it's a really big icebreaker, but it teaches the veteran and the youth how to work together. It breaks down all the things of feeling uncomfortable and et cetera. Now, at the end, you got the youth laughing with the veteran, the veterans laughing with the youth. You know, they're becoming buddy-buddy or sister-sister, you know, and everything like that, you know. But it's really cool. But so we would do a lot of those kind of icebreakers to build relationships with the youth and the veterans. And at the end of the day, they're like family, exchanging numbers and email addresses and all that kind of stuff and everything, you know, but it's really cool. It's pretty awesome.
How does fishing tie into it?
Well, fishing ties into part where, you know, we don't, in our clinics, we talk about the fishing piece, the fly fishing piece and everything, you know, so part of that is also the conservation awareness piece. We go over that. And throughout the day, I'll have a couple guys and conservation partners that will step in and come in and speak about the work that they do and say, oh, this is John Doe or Susie Jane here with this, you know, this guide company or with this conservation group. You'll be seeing them later when our deployment season kicks in, but they're here for 15 minutes to give you guys kind of like a sneak preview of what you guys are going to be doing and what you guys are going to be engaging with on this deployment or this deployment, et cetera, you know? And so they'll get like a little sneak preview, and then we'll go through a clinic of how to, you know, put on your waders properly, you know? And so one of the veterans will bring out the full blown, the waders and the boots and everything like that. And we'll put the waders on in front of all the kids and everybody, including veterans, because a lot of veterans, sometimes we get, they don't know how to fly fish either. And so everybody's there to learn. And one veteran get up and he'll say, these are wading boots, you know, and these are your neoprene, blah, blah, blah. This is what you're supposed to do in high school to put them on, you know, just all the basics and everything. And then we'll bring out the fly rod and we'll break down the whole anatomy of the fly rod in front of everybody. So now that you guys know what the fly rod is, you know how the waders are. So when deployment season starts, this is what you guys are going to be wearing. This is what you guys are going to be doing and everything like that. And so we just want to, you know, get you all into knowing what waders are, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So, but yeah. And then you got the fly box. You know, we have a big fly box and that'll be a whole nother clinic of flies. And we'll talk about it kind of like a in an umbrella way, and then we'll pass out the fly box. You know, and then you get all these oohs and ahs and oohs and ahs. And then they'll go, oh, pretty color, pretty color, pretty color, you know. And yeah, it's crazy. It's pretty fun, you know. And so that's, you know, so we do an overview on everything. And then when a deployment gets ready to come up, that's when we start having three or four different clinics. We get everybody prepped with the gear. And then when we actually get on deployment, they've been kind of like, you know, fed this. And now the deployment kicks in. And that's when we really go to town and make things happen, make the magic happen.
So the deployment is the fishing trip.
Yeah. Yeah. It's okay. So a deployment is just like, it's a brand name. Of course, it's coming from the military. I'm just, you know, retooling the meaning of that and replacing a trip or replace an outing, you know, because we don't do outings. We don't do trips. Trips are for fun. You know, trips are, you know, people pay to go on like really nice trips. We don't do outings like when we go to the park. We do deployments, and our deployments is a mission. You know, we're on a mission, an environmental mission to bring these youth out there and to not just fly fish, but to raise them up into outdoor leaders of tomorrow and ambassadors of those of this land or of these fisheries, et cetera.
Oh, that is one of the coolest things I've ever heard. Are you planning on, I mean, there's only one of you. Are you planning on expanding?
Yeah. Well, there's two of me. I got one staff, you know, I've got one staff. I'm working on another one, you know, but sooner down the road. Definitely plan on expanding. Absolutely. You know, it's crazy running a nonprofit. It's just the business of it and the fundraising of it is just, it's a daunting nightmare, you know, so we're doing good. I mean, we got really good backing and good support from corporate companies to conservation groups and government, you know. And so the more work that we do and see a success in our youth, the better off we'll be. And it's going to grow. Absolutely. Yeah.
How can people help?
People can help in many different ways. I'm constantly looking for volunteers, not veterans, but I'm constantly looking for volunteers who can help in the realm of teaching. You know, if you have backgrounds, you know, you don't have to have a degree, but if you have a background in like outdoor education and outdoor survival, you know, you have an understanding of reading, you know, the insects in the water, entomology and all that, you know, a fly fishing guide. And so constantly we got a revolving door of volunteers to step up and come in, you know, and help engage. You know, resources is always key to the organization. When we establish our deployments in different locations around the United States, you know, how that volunteer person can help, even by having the information, helping us being able to navigate logistically how to get from point A to point B in that state. Good example, like we may have a deployment in Michigan State. You know, I've never been to Michigan, so I'm doing everything online. But it does help and makes a big difference of having a contact in Michigan that understands the lay of the land and know what's going on, even from a permit standpoint as well. And so that person at ground zero that we call ground zero can relay that information to us and prep us and help us be much more prepared while traveling into that location into Michigan. You know, and so resources and knowledge helps with the organization a lot. And also financial, which that's always a key to nonprofits, you know, making, you know, small donations to large donations, whatever donation that comes in, it helps the organization regardless. Everything adds up. Yeah, that's three ways to help, basically. Yeah.
And they can do that by going through or going to soulriver.com?
Soulriverinc.org.
I'm proud of you, man. You've done really well.
Thank you. It's been hard.
Speaking of hard, how are you? How are you?
I'm okay. I'm okay. I'm good with a lot of the stuff that's happening. I'm coping. I'm dealing with it. I'm here.
It's June 10th for me, June 9th for you. So this is all really hot. Everything's really heated right now online. And I mean, I don't know. Is it the time to talk about it? Like, you know, I don't know even know where to start in this conversation. And I think it's one of many. I get really defensive when with certain things. Like I get really defensive when people, for example, somebody will have heard me say just what, half an hour ago, I said that you walked into the fly shop and I noticed that you were a black man. I mean, I wish that people would just understand that they need to dig deeper to my words. Like, I noticed that you're a black man because if I'm being totally honest, I am attracted to black men. I mean, my first boyfriend we dated for 6.5 years. He was half black. I mean, so when people say to me that, you know, you shouldn't see color, it's like, well, I can't help. Like, I do see color. How do you not see color? But right. It doesn't right. mean it's in a bad way. I see culture and I see color and I see men and I see women and yeah. I see characteristics. I mean, by people listening to the show right now who are like, April, please don't even touch the subject because we shouldn't believe in color. All lives matter, et cetera, et cetera. What's your response? Should we see color?
Absolutely. Everybody should see color. You know, it's very, very important. You know, that's a whole conversation right there, but it's very important for everybody to see color. For anyone that says, I don't see color, I understand why they say it because it's this place of them acknowledging that I'm not racist. And by me not being racist, it's I only see one person or one human. But what they don't realize, I'm going to say not we, but what they don't realize is by them saying that, it actually comes off to the other person or even to a younger kid of saying that, it actually comes off in a really kind of like a negative way of making that person feel shame of their own color. And so, you know, what we want to do is elevate what we see. When we elevate what we see, we bring it into a positive light and we make that person feel welcome in a safe space. And so acknowledging the person's color is not a bad thing, and it's not negative. What you're doing, you're acknowledging their existence, and you're acknowledging their culture, and you're acknowledging their well-being, and you're also acknowledging in a really subliminal way, safe space. You're making them feel comfortable. You know, when someone says, I don't see color, you know, for me, of the knowledge that I know today, I don't see color. That makes me feel bad. But, you know, in the subconscious to someone younger, that can bring a complex to that person, you know, and make that younger person not feel comfortable about their own color. And then you got a young girl or a young boy looking themselves in the mirror. It's like saying, I wish I was this color, because if they don't see color, it's a negative thing. And maybe if I was this color, then they can probably see me as this color, you know, whatever the case is, you know? And so it does a psychological thing, and that's kind of like where it comes from. And so I think, you know, I challenge the people out there to start, you know, acknowledging the color, and you'll see that acknowledging the color is bringing that person into your world, and you're welcoming them. You are giving them safe space. You know, you're acknowledging their existence. You know, don't say, I don't see color because I'm not a gray man. You know, you can't wash me out. You know, I'm color. I am a black man, you know, or African American, but how you want to call it, but acknowledge me, you know? And so that's important. We should be seeing color, and we should always see color, you know, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. How is all of this affecting you right now?
I think, you know, it's hard. You know, if you're leaning into the situation that has happened, you know, the death of George and what happened, he got killed, et cetera. You know, that right there struck a nerve. It opens up me feeling really hurt and sad and angry under the circumstances, regardless of what you have done. But me to know I'm one degree away from what has happened to George, that could happen to me. The circumstances and the situation can probably be different in Portland, but the outcome could be the same, just like George. And there's no justice that will protect me. And that's scary. But I've been living like that for a long time, you know, for my life of being, you know, being Black and especially being in spaces, you know, more white spaces and feeling like I'm alone, you know, and pursuing a sport of fly fishing, you know, that just, you know, puts me a little bit much more further deep into feeling vulnerable. And, you know, I've, you know, been around my brothers and sisters who are anglers. And, you know, again, it's all oh, we, you know, we're, it's just all about fishing. It's not about this, you know, well, to you, it's about fishing. And I like the fish as well, but that's a choice that you have. I don't have a choice to really think like that. I have to go through a process just because my skin's Black in order to fish. You know, I have to go through that process every day. And that's tiring. That's, you know, that is challenging. It's something that you can't take an eraser and go on my skin and erase that, you know. You know, it's just it's what it is, you know, and everything like that, you know. So it's definitely a different walk. It's a different lens. And, you know, when I did that article, I, you know, had that photo and shot of me and, you know, carrying my weapon. And, you know, randomly I carry my weapon, you know, I carry random, you know, not all the time, but I have these conversations with my father and my mom, you know, and my mom worries about me a lot. You know, here I'm in the older, I'm a man, you know, I hold my own and in my own place and everything like that. But, you know, we still have these conversations. I'm her son and she's still trying to protect me. She's still trying to protect me. My father is still trying to protect me. He says, Chad, what are you doing for your birthday? And I said, well, Dad, I was thinking about going out to do some camping, you know, and going out to the river and everything. He said, Chad, please, I know that you are into, you know, the outdoors, and I know that fly fishing means a lot, but can you just please once listen to me and go to a campground where there's a whole lot of people instead of going out by yourself? You know, my dad is still trying to protect me. He said, well, you know, I said, well, Dad, what do you think about me carrying? And I said, well, son, I get it. I understand. I carry, you carry, but it still concerns me worse because, you know, if anything was to happen, and I know that you're responsible, and I know that you'll do the right thing, but just by having that and something happens, only two things is going to happen to you, son. Either you're going to go 6 feet under, or you're going to get hurt really, really bad and do time in jail. There's not going to be no justice, you know? And so it's a scary place because at the end of the day, to be honest with you, I don't want to go through the pain of what happened to George. I don't want anybody to go through that kind of pain, let alone being in the outdoors. And imagine if you're in the outdoors, even a woman, right? You're in the outdoors and you're struggling, you're fighting for your life. Someone's coming at you. Can you imagine becoming a victim where you can only fight and fend for yourself and you may not even win at that? I mean, it's just hard to, you know, it's just really hard to digest, you know? And it's a fear that I have that I don't want to experience. And so to keep myself from not experiencing is something that I want to say, you know what? I'm not going to be a victim. I'm not going to be a victim, but I'm going to go out and enjoy, but I'm not going to allow myself to be a victim. And which is a victim of hate, a victim of ugliness, ignorance, you know? And so, yeah, you know, and everything I'm saying and sharing is like, these are like brainstorming things that goes through my head, you know, all the time, every time when I get ready to pack my gear, put in my rig and go to the river to fly fish, you know? I got to be thinking like this all the time and so many experiences I've had. And so it's tough. I don't have a solution. It's tough. You know,
it's so easy to go into a really long, extensive conversation about this, which I plan to do. Don't you worry, but I couldn't overshadow your incredible story leading up to June 9th. Sure. But I do have to ask you a couple other things. Just, you know, I had reached out to I read this book on feminism. I'm really into this book called The Guilty Feminist for people who want to read it. And she was saying, you know, the biggest group of people in North America who are discriminated against, who have the least opportunities, are Black women. Mm, mm, mm. And so I had reached out very uncomfortably to an African-American group in Australia. I must just sound like such a boob. I don't know how to approach them. And I was criticized. I mean, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. People criticize you for not posting stuff on social. Then when you do share it on social, they accuse you of tokenizing.
Right.
And
right.
That's really offensive to me because I don't know how, like, what is the difference between tokenizing and trying to be involved? Because I will guarantee you, somebody who doesn't listen to the full interview that we're doing right now will see your picture on a thumbnail on my website, and they will immediately think she's only interviewing him because he's black, which is horseshit. Of course, that's not why. I mean, we had this planned. I don't need to defend or justify.
Right.
But how does somebody get involved without feeling like they are tokenizing or like they're going to be accused of tokenizing?
No, that's a good question. I would hope that nobody wouldn't respond to this conversation with you like that. You know, my understanding of tokenizing is when a company, like a brand or something, is using you for something where they can be able to gain off the leveraging of you or your color, et cetera, you know, which will help them gain like likes or money or whatever, you know? So doing a podcast and in telling a story, I don't see tokenism even coming into play, but there may be someone out there. Again, we're in a sea of ignorance other than, you know, and around us is a lot of ignorance. There's a lot of trolls and a lot of people that, that will quickly respond straight from emotion instead of thinking about what they're about to respond to, you know, and be disrespectful.
And fear. I think people are afraid to reach out because it's super uncomfortable. Yeah. And I think people who aren't used to asking hard questions are afraid or afraid of seeing what they maybe don't want to see.
Right. Absolutely. That happens a lot, you know, and I take my hat off. I mean, I like, you know, this conversation that we're having, you know, it does take a form of courage, you know, even from your end, you know, and always my end, stepping in front of new audience and stuff, you know, there is an act of courage, you know, and to deliver something of truth and something of honesty, of real life experience that what we hope at the end creates inspiration. It creates, you know, togetherness, unity. It's supposed to help pull back the lens or change the lens and lift the veil to see things just a little bit much more different, to help educate. And the only way to do it is doing things like this, you know, and I take my hat off to companies that's willing to step out on the ledge here. That can also be dicey of their brand, but that's what creates change. That's what creates change. You know, it's being able to come together and connect and grow into one voice, you know, and people see that, they start to learn that. And again, it's to some people, they're going to jump on board. And then some of them are not going to jump on board. It may take them a little bit longer, you know, but I think in my last podcast I had, I was talking about this is the type of work that I call running a marathon. You know, it's a process that's an ongoing of work where we have to be constantly and consciously engaging all the time of differences of all walks of life in order to dismantle the ignorance that's in front of us. You know, having a one-off conversation or a one-off event, you know, or maybe protesters and stuff, it doesn't do anything. It's just a one-off. It's a 100-yard dash. Right. You know, and once when it's done, it's done. Has the situation changed? No, it will only change when we decide to actually get into this marathon together and basically run the distance. We need to run the distance together in order to dismantle the ignorance that lies in front of us. Because what we're dealing with, we're not just dealing with a 1 year of ignorance. We're dealing with, you know, 200, 300, whatever years of ignorance that has been instilled, injected into the built of the United States, you know, and that's in our system. That's everywhere we go, how we're wired. So if we're talking about dismantling ignorance, then we're talking about prepping ourselves and get ready for the long haul to walk this walk and to slowly chisel away the ignorance that's in front of us, because it's going to take not just one, but it's going to take an army to make this work. It's going to take an army, you know, an army of a collective army of all race, period, all disability. You know, it's going to take a collective army of all the multicultural of voices to come together to walk this walk here and be prepared for the long haul, you know, because it's definitely a work in progress.
Yeah, I feel like it starts like exactly like you said, it starts the protest, or, you know, it starts wherever.
Yeah.
The hundred meter dash. And then from there, though, I feel like the conversation is really where the baton keeps getting passed. If you want to talk from a marathon stance.
Absolutely.
I feel like we have to have conversations. So the question is this then, and I can only, I mean, people right now who are sick to death of me talking about feminism are rolling their eyes, but it's the only thing I can compare it to. It's like people saying to me, don't speak about being a woman, just be a woman and be great. Mm-hmm. We can see you're a woman. Don't talk about it. And I get it. And I lived like that for a really long time, but I feel like you need to have conversation to have forward movement and momentum. What about being a person of color? Would you prefer for the next person that you run into on the river to just obviously see that you're Black and say, hey, how's it going? I'm John. Nice to meet you, Chad. What fly are you using? And just treat you exactly like an equal? Or would you prefer, John, to ask you a little bit more about your story and ask you more about your struggles? Because that's a good person either way, right? Both right. those situations is right. a good person. What do you prefer?
You know, I think for me, I'm an advocate, by heart. I'm an advocate for veterans, an advocate for youth, advocate for conservation, humanity. And so I think what gets me going and what I look for is opportunity to be able to share a little bit much more deeper than just what's in my fly box. I like to be able to connect. Being able to connect gives me the opportunity to create a relationship with that person, and that relationship can easily turn into creating a greater experience of anglers on the water. You know, through that process, we are talking about the flies, but we got a little bit much more of a deeper conversation happening than just the fly fishing. When at the end of the day, when we get ready to walk off that water, the sun's going down, et cetera, you know what? We may not have caught fish, and even if we did catch fish, I can guarantee you that the fish is nothing but the byproduct. You know, the bigger picture is what we have learned about one another. The experience is what we shared together on the water and how we mentored each other on the water. And the outcome is like, I have a brother, I have a family, I have a community. And guess what? It has nothing to do with color, but he's white. Or, you know what? She's white. I have a sister, you know, but there's a little much more deeper. You know, if you go through life not wanting to know about that person and you make the judgments, but you also have a conversation about what's in the fly box, where's the depth of your own existence of being able to find yourself in a community, a friendship, or something greater that's bigger than you to be able to feel whole as a human? Where's the depth? I can't live like that. I have to have depth in my life. You know, I have to have meaning in my life. The people who I connect with has to have that too, you know? And if they don't have that, if you give me enough time with you, we'll find that depth. You know, and we'll find that meaning together, you know, and I think that's that right there is what will bring me to the front as a shield and get me going and get me to stand and fight for my brother and my sister. Because now I we have a history here, you know, what's going on, you know, and so I hope I gave you the right answer of your question there, you know, so, but yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, Chad, we are so honestly thankful to have you. Like, I am so thankful to have you in this sport. Just thank you. I know that you had mentioned, I'll wrap this up here, but I know that you had mentioned that you've been receiving some hate from all of this. That was before we were rolling and we don't need to dive into it. I think it's highly personal in a lot of ways, but why are people sending you these things?
I don't know why. I can't answer that. It's really hard. I think it's just pure ugliness that's wrapped into a lot of ignorance, you know, and it's also a reflection of where that person is at in their life, then not loving themselves. And, you know, and I think I really believe, like, if you really don't love yourself, then you're going to have problems with all kinds of stuff.
Was it primarily like, were people just reaching out to you out of the blue? Or was it primarily in response to your article or social media?
It was all in response to my article. And also I got some anonymous text messages. It was crazy. This morning, I'll read this to you right quick. I woke up this morning. It was totally irrelevant. It's irrelevant, but it's hate. And it doesn't make sense. It says, millions of blacks think having kids out of wedlock, mob violence, and dropping out of school is okay. So as a group, why should I listen to those that refuse to act civilized on my river? That's what I woke up this morning. I woke up this morning with that text. That's what I woke up this morning. You know, it's crazy. And that's like one out of like 20 texts that came through. It was crazy. On my river, you know, that's really interesting. That mentality of ownership, that mentality of mine, that really sticks with me a lot, you know, because I see that a lot amongst white male anglers. And it's this possession of ownership that is really not theirs. It's not. The river's made for everybody. It's made for everybody.
And what's so scary is that so often these are the same people who are beside us and we don't even know because absolutely. We just talk about what's in the fly box. We don't even have the conversation.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
We need to talk. There's such an opportunity there for us to be able to go beyond what's in your fly box, John, and learn their story because he or she, whoever wrote that, has a story for, you know, a reason why they wrote that. And
exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And if we just talk. I mean, obviously, in a lot of cases, it's going to be an impossible conversation, but yeah. It's not always, you know, I podcasted Spencer Green, and he's an Indigenous scholar in BC, and he really opened my eyes about the racism that they face. And my mom, who is a beautiful, incredible woman, who is not racist, we thought, my mom listened to that episode, and she said, April, I can't thank you enough for that because I didn't realize that I did have my own racial tendencies and my own we call it stereotypes. It's easier, I think, for us to say stereotypes, but it just takes a little bit of listening. That's all. Sometimes, a lot of the time.
Sometimes, a lot, you know, and that's what we don't do. We don't do that for one another, you know, especially, you know, on the comments and all that kind of stuff on the article that I wrote that got published, all that kind of stuff. All of that information, that's all these ugly stuff is all straight out. Bursts of straight emotional charge. That's it. No one's not taking the time to think, you know, and I take my hat off to a lot of the anglers out there who are taking the time because they actually are sharing it. And it says, before you respond, please think about what he's saying here. Just please think about it, you know, and that's what I'm asking. Just take your time and think about it. You know, it's not a quick charge of emotion. I'm actually challenging you because what I'm talking about when I'm challenging you is that even though that you're white, but I'm asking you to squint your eyes just a little bit and try to see it and try to feel it of what it's like having black skin and fly fishing. You know, that's what I'm challenging you to do, you know, and it's a hard thing to do. It's extremely hard, you know. And not everybody's going to take that challenge, you know, and they're going to, you know, spin off and operate from fear, operate from a troubled, past or troubled soul or whatever you want to call it. But to the ones that want to take that time and reflect and look at things from a different perspective are the ones that has that opportunity, to help create change. And as I said in the article, is that there is a privilege there to where they have whites have an opportunity to lean in to the situation with privilege to help fill the gap and dismantle the ignorance of hate and race. And that's the beauty and the benefit of Black and white coming together and working together here, you know, is when we can acknowledge and see, we can acknowledge the color, we can acknowledge where we at, we can acknowledge the differences, and we can also acknowledge the hate and ignorance at the same time and says, you know what, let's link up. It's time to link up. It's time to dismantle this, and we're going to walk together. We're going to walk together through this, and we're going to win. That's really what it's about.
And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Thank you for listening.